You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of February 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Germany's painstaking and apparently now complete assembly of a new government. Is coalition something the UK needs to learn? My guests Tova O'Brien and Geoffrey Howard will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including, is it only billionaires who are still buying newspapers? We'll look at the future of the Los Angeles Times. Also ahead,
I do not take lightly the privilege extended to me to speak from this veranda today. We did not come simply for the beauty and the hospitality of the North. We came because there is work to do, much mahi to do.
New Zealand's newish Prime Minister appears to have cracked the secret of negotiating ambiguous national holidays. Could other leaders learn from this? Or do you need to be Jacinda Ardern? And would standing in a bucket of freezing water focus your business ideas? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Tova O'Brien, News Hub New Zealand's Europe correspondent, and Geoffrey Howard, lecturer in political theory at University College London. Welcome both. We will start in Germany, which now has a government again. Although being Germany, it had just about avoided collapsing into a state of Hobbesian anarchy during the last 4 months of coalition negotiations. The practical upshot is that Germany will have more or less the same government it did before the election, i.e. a grand coalition of the Christian Democratic Union and the Social Democrats, led once again by Chancellor Angela Merkel. Tova, first of all, this still has to be ratified by Social Democrat members, but is there any chance really that that doesn't happen?
All signs point to no, but I think there is a lot of disenchantment within the Social Democrats, and so it has to go to vote. I think on 4th of March they'll decide in a postal vote whether or not to push on. All the commentators seem to be suggesting that historically it will go through, but there's still a chance it hasn't. We've been going through these, Germany's been going through these negotiations for 136 days to get to this point. So it's been hard fought and hard won to get to here. There's been a whole lot of flip-flopping, a whole lot of ultimatums, a whole lot of threats, a whole lot of bribes, a whole lot of promises. Angela Merkel has had to swallow a whole lot of dead rats to get to this point, and we're not quite there yet.
An image to conjure with, for which I'm sure our listeners thank you. Geoffrey, I wanted to talk in the main a little bit more about the idea of coalition governments Obviously, in some countries, they're very, very common. In other countries, the United Kingdom, for example, the United States being another, they are less so. Is that just weird happenstance, the way the votes just happen to fall, or does it suggest very, very different political cultures?
Well, Tova and I were talking about this before we came on, and it does seem like it partly is a function of culture, right? German politics, at least since the end of the war, has had much more of a consensual element to it than British politics or American politics. I think it also has to do with voting systems. Tova was rightly pointing out to me that proportional representation makes a huge difference in this regard. I certainly think in the American context that gerrymandering has been very bad for finding coalition in the United States. I think in the case of Germany, though, I think we're seeing the benefits of coalition government and seeing the benefits of a system that enables it. I think that this gives, even though this isn't quite what Merkel wanted, right? She wanted to have a coalition with the Free Democrats and the Green Party. It does enable her to present a strong front against Alternative for Deutschland. And I think at a time of great instability for Europe, it's really providing quite a bit of certainty in a time when we need it.
Tova, Geoffrey invokes Alternative for Deutschland there, who I think have 90-odd representatives in the current Bundestag. And obviously part of the imperative for this coalition was keeping the AfD as far from government as possible. I understand the argument, because I'm not sure what I think about this myself, that coalitions do promote perhaps more moderate, more consensual government. But is there also an argument that they let in the likes of Alternative for Deutschland? Because one of the, well, depending on how you see these things, I certainly see it as a strength of the system in the United Kingdom, that it you know, in elections where UKIP, for example, might have got 70 or 80 MPs into the House of Commons, they got none. Is there an argument that this kind of system does actually wave the yahoos and dingbats into Parliament?
For full disclosure, firstly, I'm all for proportional representation. I think it's the best system of government, but there are definitely pros and cons. And I think Germany is a good example of that, the Netherlands as well. But the rise of the far right has been this trend we've seen across Europe over the last few years, and Germany with its immigration policies as well. That was one of the main kind of proponents for that happening. I think that ultimately, if you look at the British voting system, I think something like half of the votes didn't count in the last election. And in New Zealand, every vote counts. We stole the MMP system from Germany. Every vote counts in New Zealand. So for better or worse, at least voters have more of a voice under PR, under MMP. And I think that's the better approach to government, is a parliament that's more reflective of the population, diversity of the population.
Geoffrey, going back to the idea of coalitions, the United Kingdom has, of course, been trying to figure out how they work in the last decade or so. In 2010, a hung parliament resulted in a coalition between the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats. There's now kind of a coalition between the Conservatives and the Democratic Unionist Party. Is that the same kind of thing as what we see in Germany, or have the British still not yet quite figured out how to do this?
I think the Brits haven't figured it out. I think it takes a lot of years of coalition government to learn to establish a certain political practice so that people understand what the moves are, how you actually run a coalition government effectively. But I think it's something we should certainly keep trying. I mean, when you have a system where people's votes, where people continually are voting for a party and that party is never being elected, or they never feel like their vote matters, it really does start to bring into question the legitimacy of the system. I think the other thing that's going on here is that when you have polities like the UK and the US that have these two big main political parties, it encourages a kind of tribal thinking. And I think that in the media, this shows up most strikingly, because you get a situation in which people flock to the new sources that reaffirm the views that they already subscribe to. And I think in Germany, you don't get as problematic a kind of echo chamber effect as you get in the UK and the US.
Tove, the argument, or one of the arguments against coalitions, is that they become unwieldy. And I guess the question is, how unwieldy is too unwieldy? And looking at New Zealand and Jacinda Ardern, who we will come back to later in the show, but she is faced with trying to hold together a coalition of Labour, New Zealand First and the Greens. That's going to take some doing.
It is. So our Labour Party, our populist party, the New Zealand First and the Green Party, as advertised by their name. So it is tricky. And I think coalitions as well, you don't want to end up in a position where you've got the tail wagging the dog. But Jacinda Ardern, to her credit, and also to the credit of the leader of the New Zealand First Party, who is an old dog, he's been around the parliament for a long time, decades and decades and decades and decades and decades. It's a legacy issue for him to try and hold this coalition together. So I think she's got that on her side. Winston Peters, the leader of New Zealand First, doesn't want to let this thing flop, and they can't really afford to look, because it is such a cobbled together coalition, they can't afford to let it look unstable and disunified. So I think she's got that going for her, which is kind of, you know, success through problematic problematic things.
Okay, well, let's move along now. Due in no small part to the tireless promotional efforts of President Donald Trump, the last couple of years have been a boom time for the New York Times and the Washington Post, among other legacy print titles. One bastion of oldie-worldy journalism which has largely failed to cash in has been the Los Angeles Times, which has been plagued by infighting with its parent company Trunk and ructions within the newsroom. Deliverance may now be at hand in the shape of pharmaceuticals billionaire Patrick Soon-Shiong, who is believed to have spent $500 million on the LA Times and its sister journal, the San Diego Union-Tribune, as well as some local titles. Geoffrey, cheers were reported in the newsroom at these tidings. Is this unalloyed good news?
Well, I think the people at the Los Angeles Times certainly are greeting it as good news. They've had an extremely acrimonious harmonious relationship with the parent company, Trunk, who fired a very popular editor and publisher a number of months back and installed their own preferred editor and publisher, who continued to feud relentlessly with the members of the Los Angeles Times, accusing some of them of being morally bankrupt at one point in response to leaking a particular argument that had happened inside the building. So I think they're really looking forward to a change. And this is a guy who's really been on the out with Trunk. He was removed from Trunk's board after feuding with the chairman. And he seems, by all accounts, to be a guy who takes seriously the importance of a free press and the importance of an independent press.
Tova, how have we got to a point at which we are cheering on the purchase of newspapers by billionaires, as we've seen with Jeff Bezos from Amazon buying the Washington Post, John Henry, owner of the Boston Red Sox, buying the Boston Globe? I mean, it's been traditional to think of the billionaire press baron as kind of a cross between William Randolph Hearst and Montgomery Burns, but now they're being seen as saviours.
Yeah, the Rupert Murdoch type character is now the knight in shining armour coming to the aid of the poor disenfranchised newspaper. But I think a lot of that is to do with advertising revenues with Google and Facebook and Snapchat and various other social media who are sopping up all of the money from marketers, from advertisers, and unfortunately that has been to the detriment of print. But I think also, the previous model, this Trunk model for the LA Times, clearly wasn't working. At least this guy, they're saying, they're touting it as, you know, local ownership for the LA Times for the first time in 18 years. $500 million is also a positive sign. It's apparently, you know, he's paying a premium. This guy's got deep pockets. Forbes estimated his fortune at something like $8 million. So hopefully, the hope is, and it does feel incongruous to my previous kind of principles around this, but hopefully this will mean a greater investment in the LA Times and in traditional print journalism.
But Jeffrey, do we now need to start thinking of newspapers, which are fantastically expensive things to run, at least if you're going to do it properly, do they need to be thought of as exercises in philanthropy rather than a way for anybody to make money?
Quite possibly. The problem is we haven't specified a philanthropic model that can pay for itself, right? And so, you know, we don't live in a culture in which people think of newspapers as organizations that they're supposed to donate to or give large grants to.
Although some have tried. And actually, weirdly, yep. Tova invoked Rupert Murdoch. There is an argument that for years he did run some of his titles as philanthropic exercises because they sure weren't making any money.
I think if we... So long as we don't have an arrangement where we basically just have an oligarchy of billionaires running all the newspapers, then I think we want to welcome a diversity of different approaches. Some newspapers that operate for profit, some newspapers that embrace the philanthropic model. What makes it so unreliable, our current arrangement, is that it all depends on the personality of the billionaire that happens to own the newspaper. And it's an extremely unreliable situation, such that we're cheering when one billionaire buys a newspaper, but we're lamenting it the next day. That's not good enough. We need some kind of institutional structure that can reliably produce quality journalism.
Tova, do you get the sense, and this goes back to my introduction, which is my own pet theory, that this will be Donald Trump's legacy, that basically everything that he really didn't want to happen is what his presidency is going to cause to happen. You know, it has been an absolute lottery win for the New York Times and the Washington Post. Is the fact of Trump's presidency and the media circus that it has prompted, is that skewing the market for old school newspapers? Is it possible that the Los Angeles Times would not seem like quite a good buy if almost anybody else was president?
Yeah, possibly. But I think maybe this goes back a bit to what Jeff was saying as well. And just the people in there, we're saying about the United Kingdom, people just kind of moving into their own echo chambers. And I think that possibly applies with print media and social media. And I'm not convinced that's necessarily a good thing. I mean, there's the print in the United States. I think it's that there's more of a call for journalism now than there ever has been. But I also think that people who like Donald Trump, who retweet all of his tweets, who go to him for the advice and the say of what's happening in the White House, they're going to continue to do that and go to him rather than the Washington Post or the LA Times or the New York Times.
Jeffrey, if you had the kind of resources available to Patrick Soon-Shiong, and I don't know what lecturing in political theory pays.
Afraid not.
Never mind. Would you think something like the Los Angeles Times was an enticing purchase?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, certainly, once you have a lot of money, what you want after that is power and influence, right? And you might want power and influence in order to make money, make more money, or you might want power and influence simply to shape the world in accordance with your convictions. And it looks like this pharmaceuticals billionaire has a certain set of views, and he thinks that by becoming the owner of the Los Angeles Times, he'll better be able to shape the world in accordance with those views. So, yeah, if I were a billionaire and had made enough billions, then sure, why not?
He has a strong philanthropic bent as well, doesn't he? And I think he's been quoted as saying, we need newspapers, we need this intellectual integrity, we need writers and editors who are passionate about this work. So he's making all of the right noises, but time will tell.
But I'll put that same question to you, Tova, and again, I don't know what New Zealand News Hub pays. Perhaps it is within your...
Virtually on par.
But if you did buy the Los Angeles Times or something of the sort, what would you do with it?
I would have a strong editorial focus. I would defer to my journalists, and I would try not to interfere in the journalistic or an editorial process, and I would use it for good. Not evil.
Spoken like a journalist, especially the bit about not interfering with journalists.
He has a strong philanthropic bent, though, as well. This guy's, you know, he's set out himself, in his own words, to solve cancer. And that has been a kind of backbone of his career in pharmaceuticals. Fun fact, though, as well, we were talking about this before we came on air, he's actually been sued by the singer Cher in the past because apparently he convinced her to sell stocks in some drug company for far less than they were worth. So, you know, maybe he's got a bad streak too.
The headline,
maybe I'm defaming him.
If Cher's suing you, you might be doing something right.
the headlines about Cher and Cher's would obviously have written themselves. We are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Tova O'Brien and Geoffrey Howard. Coming up next, an admittedly belated Happy Waitangi Day to our New Zealand listeners.
Canada's welcoming attitude is luring entrepreneurs and investors. Monocle Films travels to Montreal to bear witness to the revival of Quebec's largest city and takes note of its success. As government initiatives help drive the change, we hear from Canada's innovation minister about how the country is capitalizing on restrictive US visa policies.
This is a great opportunity for Canada to differentiate itself, to really focus on promoting diversity and using diversity as a means to create more opportunities. And one key area that's really demonstrated that in a meaningful way is immigration. And we think this does really well compared to other jurisdictions in terms of branding Canada, but also really providing the fuel for the innovative economy, which is creative, thoughtful people who want to take risk.
Why startups thrive in Canada. Play now in the film section at monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Geoffrey Howard and Tova O'Brien. Yesterday, February 6th, was Waitangi Day, the National Day of New Zealand. And like Australia Day 11 days previously, Waitangi Day is a reliable cause of controversy because, like Australia, New Zealand was built on land which was taken from somebody else. In recent years, Kiwi Prime Ministers have thought it tactful to avoid or have been uninvited to the ceremony in Waitangi itself, which commemorates the signing of the 1840 Treaty between the British Crown and New Zealand's largest indigenous tribe. However, New Zealand's new Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern did turn up yesterday to what seems to have been a generally positive reaction. Tova, has something shifted around Waitangi Day, or do people just like Jacinda Ardern?
I think something's shifted, and I think people like Jacinda Ardern. I think it's a bit of both, but there's definitely a palpable shift this year. I covered it, Waitangi Day, a lot in Waitangi when I was in the Press Gallery in Parliament in New Zealand, and I remember the first year I covered it, the tension in the air before the then Prime Minister John Key arrived was utterly intense. The Secret Service, the Diplomatic Protection Squad, they seemed nervous, journalists were nervous, people were nervous, everyone felt very much on edge. And then, of course, when John Key did arrive, someone threw a basket of small fish at him. And protest is a big part of Waitangi Day. People throw all sorts of things, not just fish, but mud, dildos. The Queen had a T-shirt thrown at her back in the 90s when she went. And I think it's an important part of the day. For, you know, people say it's for better or for worse, and it can overshadow perhaps, but I think it's an important part of the day in reflecting on the day, reflecting on the complexities of the modern history of New Zealand. But Jacinda Ardern, her reception was markedly different because, as you say, the last two prime ministers haven't even bothered to show up because they said there was a security threat. not only did Jacinda Ardern show up, she showed up for 5 days, not just the usual couple of days, flit in and flit out again and do your duty. She showed up for 5 days. She spent a lot of time with the community. She was welcomed onto the Madai by a woman called Titiwhai Harawira, who's a very respected but controversial figure up in Northland. She made our former Prime Minister, Helen Clark, cry once at Waitangi when she was leader of the opposition. So she approached it differently. She spoke on the Madai for the first time a woman Prime Minister has ever done that. So she approached it differently from the get-go to the end, and she didn't go in there bolshy or kind of treating it as a day for politicians. She was there and she was deferential to the people.
Is there a difference between the controversy around Waitangi Day and the controversy around Australia Day, with which obviously as an Australian I am more familiar with? Because it's often suggested that the relationship between the two countries and their Indigenous peoples is altered by the fact that in New Zealand there was a treaty and Australia there was not. Is there a difference between what the argument about the National Day is about?
Yeah, I think there is. I think, and also what happened after the treaty and what happened after the National Day that we commemorated. I think New Zealand's, it's hugely complex and we didn't do a lot right, but the treaty process beyond 1840 has also been one of reconciliation, and the government has tried to make amends for a lot of the harm and wrongs that were done. And I think in Australia that wasn't necessarily the case until more recently.
Because, Geoffrey, there is an ongoing row in Australia about whether the date of Australia Day should be changed, whether we should pick another date. January 26th commemorates the arrival of the first convict fleet and the formal claiming of New South Wales for the British Crown. I came round to thinking that I actually quite like the situation as it is, whereby we have the National Day on the ambiguous date and we have the good old row every year about what sort of history we have and what sort of country we'd prefer to be. I think if it was moved to another date, people would forget the aspect of the commemoration of the conquest of the original territory. Do you think the United States either, you could argue sensibly or cynically, has kind of dodged this one by having your National Day on a date which doesn't really have any reference to the Indigenous people?
I think absolutely, right. I think absolutely. And even the Thanksgiving holiday is predicated on this myth of wonderful, peaceful coexistence between the early settlers and the Native Americans, rather than the actual story, which is one of the United States government continually breaking every single treaty it ever made with Native American tribes. So I think that it's shocking that the United States hasn't atoned for slavery in a proper way, and it's as shocking that it hasn't atoned for the injustices committed against Native Americans. And I think that's why people have been so drawn to what Jacinda Ardern has been doing here, which is that, unlike her predecessors, she seems to be expressing the idea that there is this national obligation to atone for historic injustice and to make up for the disadvantage faced by Maori community members as a result of that historic injustice. I mean, the insult expressed when the two previous prime ministers refrain from going on the grounds that it's just too dangerous to be close to these people, right? When the government itself is responsible for the fact that there's higher incarceration rates among Maori people, higher unemployed rates among Maori people. And so I think what we need here is an expression of the thought that we have obligations to make up for historic injustice. I think Jacinda Ardern's doing that wonderfully. I think you're right that Australia Day helps to achieve that as well. And I think there's a complete lack of that in the United States.
And I think people in New Zealand feel similarly to what you were saying, Andrew, as well. It's not a day necessarily of celebration. A National Day isn't a day of celebration, but it's a day of reflection. And so it's important to recognise that, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly that goes with that.
I mean, I also think that Australia and New Zealand also have the advantage that we both actually have a kind of an alternative national day, which is the same date, Anzac Day, April 25th. But going back to Jacinda Ardern and Waitangi Day, if we're agreed that she's handled this really well and that she's said and done the right things and, you know, behaved impeccably, how high a wire is she walking politically? Because the difficulty, and you could argue that it's a difficulty or otherwise, or whether it's just something that needs to be faced with a certain amount of courage and backbone, certainly in Australia, is that there is always the backlash in the wings. There's people resentful that any kind of gestures of contrition towards the Indigenous people and their descendants. Is that the case in New Zealand? Will this have played badly with a certain sector?
bugger them, is all I say to that. I mean, even if it does, there's just right and there's wrong. And in this case, there needs to be a degree of reconciliation. There needs to be politicians listening to the people. And that's why protest isn't a bad thing at Waitangi either. It's an important thing because people, there's always a peaceful hikoi as well, a march at Waitangi every year. And that is people up in Northland where it is talking about the issues that are affecting them. They very rarely have television cameras and politicians there listening in the way that they do. And so protest is important on those days. Reconciliation is important, and it's vitally important that our politicians listen to people. And if there are a bunch of grumpy old white men predominantly, to use the kind of oft-used stereotype, then bugger them.
Well, speaking as a grumpy old white man, I couldn't possibly agree more. Finally tonight, though, spare a thought for the entrepreneurs of Finland, certain of whom have spent today partaking in an event called Polar Bear Pitching, which is not, as the name suggests, an especially hardcore variant of the locally popular recreation of wife carrying, which is a thing, look it up, but it's sort of a business symposium. Startups spruik for investment cash while standing in a pool of icy water. Jeffrey, how many pitches that they hear do you think are for really thick waterproof boots?
Quite a few, I reckon. Quite a few. I mean, I think it's great. So what I say to our PhD students in our department is you have to have your elevator pitch. You have to have the 30-second version of what you're working on, the 2-minute version, and the 5-minute version, because you never know who you're going to be stuck in an elevator with and who you're going to have to say to. And I think the worst thing, especially for academics, is droning on and on and on about an idea that could come across in just one sentence.
What do you think, Tove? Is this as weird as it sounds, or do you think it would helpfully promote a certain amount of brevity?
I think it would helpfully promote a certain amount of brevity, and I think that we need to take this model and apply it to other parts of our society. Let's go back to politics, perhaps, and I think that, you know, in the parliament, perhaps politicians will be helped with a little bit of Baltic sea water and Arctic ice to maybe get their points across more efficiently. I also think that it costs a hell of a lot of money to run the House of Commons, and so if we lugged these things into the Commons, force these politicians into it, would be, you know, there'd be a massive boon to the GDP of this country as well. I think that you know, despite perhaps my lack of it tonight, I do appreciate succinctness, and I don't think it's any bad thing whatsoever.
Both academics and journalists do have in common the fact that from time to time we have to pitch stuff. Jeffrey, have you acquired any helpful tips for pitching that ideally probably don't involve standing in a bucket of icy water?
Yeah,
or maybe standing in a bucket of icy water works for you, in which case, let's have it.
Well, know your audience is the first one. I mean, this isn't an academic example. I remember I was auditioning for the musical Sweeney Todd at one point when I was in college. You know, this musical about a diabolical, homicidal barber, very brooding part. And I decided to audition with the George Gershwin song, I've got rhythm, I've got music, really upbeat, happy song. Next, right, I was out of that audition studio right away. This guy is not for the part. So if you only have 30 seconds, you really have to make sure that the very first thing you say is going to grab him and convince him.
Tove, what about you? I mean, pitching as a journalist, especially to editors whose attention spans are not something you can always take for granted, what have you learned?
I tend to just dump them in a paddle pool full of Arctic ice and Baltic salt water and just hope for the best, torture them until they agree with what I'm planning to do. But it's the same principle, I think. Know your audience, get to the point as quickly as you possibly can and argue for the benefits.
Have you ever had a pitch go disastrously wrong?
My pitches over here tend to be via email and involve a lot of budgeting, and the disastrously wrong is usually when I pitch for something that's only going to cost X amount and then it ends up costing X, 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 X amount instead, and then having to be held accountable for that after the fact. But no, I haven't had any pitches so far go disastrously
wrong. See, I quite get a lot turned down because they're obviously just going to cost way too much money. So is what I'm learning here, the secret is just to say no, it won't, then go and do the thing and then say afterwards, yeah, I ran up a bit more of a tab than I expected to. What are you going to do?
Don't include the extra luggage. Don't include your per diems on your budgets. Don't include anything you don't have to, the bare minimum. That's my approach.
I hope nobody on the editorial floor is listening to this. Jeffrey, any tips other than obviously lying about how much it's going to cost?
I mean, I think that, you know, when my students are given a 3,000-word length limit for their essay or a 2,000-word limit for their essay, they're going to end up saying the same thing. And the 2,000-word essay is always going to be better than the 3,000-word essay, because I think forcing yourself to boil down your ideas into in a shorter amount of time really allows you to weed out the extraneous content. It's like the size of a wallet. If you have a big fat wallet, you'll throw all your receipts in there. You'll put any, you know, stamp card you get from the coffee shop in there. But if you're a really thin, narrow wallet, you put only the stuff that matters.
Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Tova O'Brien and Jeffrey Howard, thanks both for joining us. No guests were forced to stand in buckets of icy water during the making of this program. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and James Kitchen. Our studio manager was David Stevens. There's more music next at 1900. It's The Entrepreneurs with Matt Alagaya. There's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening.